Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to this episode of All Things Policy. I'm Anupam Manur and I have with me today Soumya Nandan and Shambhavi Naik. Today we're going to be discussing about women in the workforce. Just to set the context, generally in the world, women's labor force participation rate is kind of terrible if you compare that to men. And there are many known problems of not having equal pay for equal work and so on. India's case seems to be an aberration, even in this context, that India's women labor force participation rate is as low as 23% or 22%. And the company that we are keeping in this is also reflects how bad the situation is. Pakistan, Saudi Arabia are the countries which have a very similar rate of women in the workforce. Bangladesh actually is doing much better than us. Just to give an example, it's at 36%. China's is about 55-56%. And even Western countries like US and Europe is about 78-80%. Having 100% seems like a distant dream. Back to the Indian context, today we're going to be discussing about what are the specific kind of problems that women face in the workforce, and even there in the organized sector, in an office setup and so on. We're not even going to be touching upon some of the more difficult issues such as what happens to women in the workforce in the construction sector, in the informal sector, or in a factory setup and so on. I think that warrants a different conversation all by itself. Today we're going to be discussing...
Or in the military sector.
A non-existent military sector, I mean. So that's what we're going to be talking about. Soumya, I want to start with you. What do you think are some of the biggest problems that women face in the workforce?
So for a lot of roles that women take up, I'm mostly going to emphasize on the formal sector, you know, where people have jobs where they get to offices. So in those instances, we have seen an era of, you know, the call center kind of a situation, right, where it's demanding in terms of being in shifts which change like every fortnight. And sometimes, you know, given the kind of demanding roles that women have back home, you know, be it, you know, the motherhood role or the caregiver role for aging parents, it used to be one of those instances where a lot of women said, oh, it's great because the entry barrier is low. But when you get to the workplace, you realize that your health is compromised in the process. So looking at that pattern where at least a lot of women got onto the workforce, we also see that there is a pattern where especially the infrastructure not complementing in women getting to workspaces, right? A lot of times women have, you know, roles or organizations they aspire to work with, but just sheer because of commute challenges, because of safety when they have to get back home rather late is, I think, the, you know, key factors. But once that barrier is crossed and you get to the workplaces, the challenges would be like, you know, at times you need to compromise, you know, your role as a mother or, you know, other instances that could kind of take your time away from home. So you'll have to negotiate in terms of reduced working hours. Sometimes it is the kind of time off you might need because of things like, you know, health issues that a child has, or even for that matter, even moral obligations and social, social setup in our country is such that women ought to be there for a few things, whereas, you know, probably men can get away with it. So I think these are the ones which come to my mind upfront, which could probably defeat women from being at workspaces.
I think there's a lot to unpack there. Let's just pick up the first aspect, which is, you know, safety, which seems to be, I think, one of the most critical aspects in all of this and the most critical factor. Until recently, I think the Karnataka government, for instance, had disallowed women from doing any kind of night shifts. Right. And so you're talking about an entire industry and an entire kind of work which is completely has forgotten women and is not allowing women. And the reason for that is basically societies and the state's inability to fix basic safety issues. Right. And therefore, there could be a lot of women, for example, who might prefer a night shift or who might prefer, you know, working hours at whatever convenience they have. But you're not giving them that choice. And for me, that by itself just reflects of how poorly we've done in this infrastructure aspect that you picked up on. And then there is, you know, multiple things. Women don't feel safe in a bus, or they don't feel necessarily, I don't know, probably things are changing with the metro, but other forms of public transport has not been safe, which means that you add this compliance burden for companies saying that if you have women and if they work, I think, beyond 7 o'clock or so, and then you necessarily have to arrange for a cab and a transportation. So then companies would say, why do I have to take on this additional responsibility and a compliance cost, which you don't have to do with men? So therefore, again, you're creating a inherent bias in the system for companies to choose men over women. Shambhavi, any thoughts on the safety and infrastructure aspect of it?
Yeah, I mean, as a working woman, I think every time I step out of the house, I have to always tell my parents when I'll be coming back. There was actually a point of time in which my parents used to ask me to share my Google Live location with them to make sure I got home okay.
That's kind of scary, right?
Yeah, and it's just an unnecessary burden to be carrying around it. I would love to stay back late, work, finish, anything. So in my previous workplace at the National Center for Biological Sciences, for example, they have a pretty good system, especially for those who stay in close proximity. They used to get dropped off at home and the driver used to wait and make sure that everyone got inside the house and then move on to the next location. So those things do actually help. But you're right. I mean, it's an unnecessary compliance issue for a company when the problem is not essentially that created
that of
by
the company. It's an overall society, I mean, first state level failure or government level failure, and then it's, of course, the bigger aspect is that it's a societal level failure. But it doesn't end there, though, is it? I mean, just infrastructure and safety is one aspect of it. But the other, I think, bigger aspect that you said, and this is coming from a more social angle, is that there are probably unreasonable expectations of a working woman. So there's the entire burden, of course, at the workplace, which I think everyone shares. But then outside of the workplace, back at home, it's an additional job or two. I would say at least two additional jobs, if you ask me. And that is something that men don't necessarily share that burden at all, right? So
yeah, the social expectations are really weird. So for example, I have faced this a few times. So a lot of science conferences will occur irrespective of festivals or any holidays being taken into consideration. Typically will happen Diwali.
Right.
Okay. So it is a different thing to say that, okay, I have to go into work for 3 hours and come back at Diwali. So my husband could probably be able to do that. But for me, I have to make sure that there are sweets at home, that someone's drawing the rangoli outside the house. You know, these are things that he will not ever consider. And so all of those expectations, if I fail at them, then I'm not a good daughter-in-law, a good daughter, a good wife or whatever, right? And I get judged on that, which I don't personally, my husband doesn't care. But there are so many other things that you have to do before Diwali and after Diwali that men don't have to do. Men probably don't even think about it. Right?
Absolutely.
So it is not just like taking that one day off.
Honestly, I'm going to put myself in the firing this thing line here. I had not even considered that this could be a problem. Right. And I'm sure that a lot of people are also in similar vein, that they wouldn't even have considered that this is a problem. And now if you add one extra layer of complication, which is that of a working woman who's also, see, happens to be a mother who has children of her own, I think that complicates things like probably 10x.
Yes.
Soumya?
Yes. Because the context shifting, right? Every moment you're either, even at your workplace, though you want to kind of switch off and say, okay, this is my time here, so I will not worry about things. But you just need that message from that child who's reached home that, yeah, I'm home, kind of a thing, just to be reassured that, you know, they're safely back home. And sometimes I've also seen, working women struggle with the fact that, oh, I don't want to take a Ola or a Uber cab, but I don't mind, sending my daughter via an auto, because you feel a little more safe in that, or I don't know, something that it kind of creates some level of satisfaction that, yeah, once this is more safer, I don't know what, but it kind of reestablishes that component. And while Shambhavi said this context thing, right, like a lot of things are happening where you need to pay attention and some you can let go. But even there, the trade-offs are such that you'll get to hear from the society or your neighbors that, you know, you were not there when things, you know, went wrong. So you can't possibly physically be available at different instances in different places. But as much as possible, you should also get your infrastructure and family tuned into it. Like in my family, we're the first generation of women at workspace. So a lot of things, like you said, unless you're told, you don't think that it's a very obvious one, right? Like at home, for me, my husband being in the kitchen is something that's, it's a daily routine. But I've seen a lot of people, you know, mocking at it, saying, oh, you know, a man is trying to look at daily menu and what's getting cooked and all of that, whereas he enjoys it. But when you see the ridicule coming from another side, then it makes people think that, are we even growing out of this, or we are making it deeper in that sense? So I feel it's about the society and the family also, which should equip themselves to, you know, think of a template if that can be, you know, done, so that it's easier for people to navigate through
this. Anupam, do you cook?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Occasional special cooking?
No, at least twice a week. But, okay. So, yeah. Not as much as I would have liked, but sure. So, the next obvious kind of question, just veering off from what you were saying, is that there are benefits beyond just for the woman who's working. I think as just a moral society, we should have equality in all of these things, that we should try and achieve for a far higher labor force participation rate of women, and that we should give workplaces where women are comfortable and so on. But it also has knock-off benefits, what I would call as positive externalities. And in the first kind of research that we had done some time back was that every woman that you hired created at least one additional job, if not actually three additional jobs.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Which is just that, and that kind of reflects off the kind of and the number of jobs that a woman actually does, which is largely unpaid as well. So, for example, you would can easily think of a scenario where if there is a person who is working, who's a woman who's working, then you might have created a job for a cook, for a nanny sometimes, for some other kind of caregiver. You could actually hire a nurse who to look after aging parents, for example. That's
right.
Another job that women does. So you have some stats on this particular issue, Soumya.
Yeah. So referring to the Pew Research Center data, right? So there, the study indicates that while women are at workspaces, there is a highly obvious chance that 1.21 times, you know, the children who grow up in these environments will get employed. Like,
so
they will,
the daughter of a woman who's working, yes, has a 1.2 times higher probability of getting hired.
Right. Yes. And also aspiring to be in jobs that are much more, you know, aspirational than look at, you know, I just want to be in a job, but look at it more as a career perspective and with higher incomes as well. And I think slowly it also wears off the guilt that most working women carry, right? And, you know, these children grow into a phase where they don't mind spending more time at work, which is very engaging intellectually, and not feel guilty about coming back to, you know, household work a little more later.
Shambhavi, do you want to weigh in on this?
Right. So I have been looking at the issue mainly from women scientists and women in the research workforce in the country. So worldwide, the numbers are about 28% women in science.
That's abysmally low.
Yeah. And in India, it's 14%, which
of
is...
Of course.
So research has actually shown is that if there are more women in research teams, then the teams are more productive, A, because they bring in other perspectives, and also just mixed gender teams, and I guess diverse teams of any sort, not only limited to gender, do better at creating products. The other thing is that a lot of, at least that products that come out of scientific research, which are meant for women, are better designed by women, and that is a no-brainer. But like, for example, did you know that the home pregnancy test was designed by a woman? It was designed by someone who was visiting a lab, and her job was to document something else. And she visited the lab where they were doing the urine analysis for pregnancy testing. And she thought, well, as a woman, this is something that should be done in the privacy of your own house. I would like not a doctor telling the result, but to figure this out for myself, because it is a life-changing decision. And so she went home and she created the kit herself. And then she went back to the original company where she saw the lab testing being done. And they patented it and they manufactured it.
Right.
So this is a group of men who have been doing this forever, without realizing that there's a requirement for the woman to be able to make to have this decision known to her in the privacy of her own home, and the woman can just go and change this, right? So this is where women in science particularly are essential.
That makes absolute sense. I mean, because as we've spoken about before, there can be hundreds of such instances where men don't even realize that something is a problem, which is why you need, I mean, as you said, you need diversity of all kinds. You cannot have, you know, one set of people trying to solve problems for another set of people without even A, being able to recognize the problems, B, understand the problems, and obviously with very little clue of how to solve the problems.
So the study actually showed that diverse teams have more collective intelligence and are therefore smarter than just having white men in the US making decisions for the entire world.
I agree, Shambhavi. In the hiring world, I think that also plays up quite well. I mean, in HR conversations itself, right? Like most people also think, if you hire women, they'll be on maternity leave, or, you know, the kind of breaks that they will need might slow down the project. I think it's, like you said, it's the collective intelligence that will play up towards the productivity of the team itself. And even, in fact, for a lot of women, while I interview them even now for different positions, they're moving, leaving jobs that matter to them in terms of careers, and they're probably just joining their husband because their career aspirations are more important than women looking at a career. So it's become a job. So I need something for next 2 years because my husband is here on an assignment. After that, I'll look at something else. So it's very temporary and it's not aspirational in that sense. So
yeah, I think that's one of the points that we need to think about, is that we all always go by these numbers, right? So I just said 14% are in science workforce. And we say, should it be 50, should it be 100? And I don't think that approach is correct, because I don't think all women want to work. And I don't think all men also want to work. And it should be an option available for those who want to work. And I think if we reach that kind of a situation where each and every woman who wants to work has the opportunity and freedom and feels safe enough to work, I think that's a win for us. Instead of trying to figure out that, no, we want 50% or we want 100% workforce participation. I don't think that a number game is going to change this.
No, you're absolutely right. I think every individual, whether it is a male or a female, has a unique set of preferences and a unique, ratio of work to leisure that everyone wants. And therefore, every person should have that. Ideally, every person should have an opportunity of choosing that for themselves. I don't think we ever speak about having 100% employment, right? I mean, full employment is a myth that economists have created. But you cannot have that. I mean, in fact, then you're taking away people's choices and preferences.
So particularly from the life sciences experience, what we have seen is that, for example, a lot of the campuses that hire for faculty positions, there is an age restriction of 35 years, which is like an unspoken age restriction, but we have seen this more often than not, that if you're older than 35, your chances of getting a faculty position in the life sciences is lower.
Right.
Now, to do a BSc, an MSc, a PhD, then a postdoc and get enough papers out, so I have male friends who have barely managed to do this by the age of 34, who have come from really privileged laboratories, right? To think that if instead of that guy, there was a girl there who had one child or two children, she would not have been able to do this at the age of 34, even if everything else had matched.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that is a problem that policy should be able to figure out, but we just have not applied ourselves to a problem. I think the other thing is that we seem to have reduced everything down to, women have children and that's why they are not participating more. And we fail to take into account everything else that a woman is expected to do as well.
So just taking on from where Shambhavi just spoke about how the science community thinks about it, right? When women have education backgrounds like PhDs, or they've done their master's degree and they've really slogged it out, I think it makes it a little more difficult, and they would think about saying, I at least need to kind of stabilize my career. I need to go after these aspirations that I have before the so-called the social norm saying, settling in, right? And for most people, settling in means, transition from education world into having, getting into commitment like marriage and then having children, that kind of a template. So these are decisions now, at least we see, and even research backs it, is that, women now probably delay the decision of marriage and having children. And only once career aspirations are met, probably they're thinking about it. And we've also seen evidence in the past that at leadership levels, women slow down in their career for a reason that it becomes demanding. And, you know, having all the commitments being met at that phase is tough. So you turn down promotions.
Right. My big question now, if just slightly moving away, is we've been speaking about today, right now, about problems that are not entirely new, right? Because these issues have been in the, at least in the popular discourse for the last 30, 40 years, since the first wave of, conversations about equality and so on came into at least popular discourse. What has happened since then? Has there been any changes, or will we have the same kind of conversation another 10 years down the line? Because that would be truly depressing for me. So is there anything positive that we are seeing? Any positive trends? The Indian government, for example, passed this maternity bill, which at least means, I don't know if they've gotten it right or wrong. I don't want to be the one to comment on it, but at least they're thinking about these things. Are there changes in law? Are there changes in company practices that we can, at least flag saying we're going in the right direction?
Yeah, I think I would have just come to the maternity benefit, right? 6 months is, being a mother, I think 6 months is a good time to settle down with everything that's overwhelming in that phase. And as a biological system, it takes time to recover from what's happened inside your body, right? So I think it's a good step to look at, 6 months. And it gives confidence for a lot of us as women to say, okay, this is compatible, this is possible, and this is doable, because you also see the child is growing, and it gives you that promise that, oh, okay, you can look at having a nanny, or you can trust a system of a daycare, and you can opt in for these things. And even in terms of, other things that are moving in this direction is hopefully the infrastructure can get better. But at least, with the metros and other things that are coming in, like, for example, earlier, I know if women are asking for, say, cars, because, you want to drive home back safe, even though it's a late meeting that you've attended, there used to be a conversation as to, do you really need it, kind of a thing, whereas it would be a default thing that the men will go for. But now when you have the financial ability to contribute to the income of the household, I think you are also empowered to take decisions of such order, which will also add to the safety of being at places where you need to stay up late. Yeah.
In the sciences, particularly, I think the government has been more proactive. They have come up with a lot of initiatives for women who are looking to re-enter into the workforce, particularly after a maternity break or any other break that they have had to take for family reasons. So those opportunities exist. But I think we have not been able to boil down the problem of why women are leaving in the first place. So, for example, these fellowships that the DBT and DAC offer are 3 years. And so a lot of
who offers?
The Department of Biotechnology, the Department of Science and Technology, they all have these fellowships, but they are for 3 years. So women take it for 3 years, but they do not have a lot of job security afterwards. So we see a lot of drop down in the women's participation after those 3 years. So we have not been able to give ample thought to why the women left in the first place. Again, maternity is kind of looked at as a woman's problem, like I said before. Mm. We have not thought about whether introducing paternity benefits along with maternity leave could actually help get the woman back into the workforce quicker. Whether after the 6 months that a woman is off, if the father can stay home for a month or so, whether that will ease her coming back to the workforce. We have not thought about those questions.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if I could only add like my 2 cents here, giving only maternity leave and benefits also has a signaling problem, that it's only the mother's problem to deal with the child, and not talking about the father's role at all.
Not even a problem, right? I have known a number of men who would like to stay home with the child. No, just to bond. They're like, after 3 months, the child still doesn't recognize me because I'm there only for like 3 hours a day.
But it's a signaling thing, right? I mean, now the message you're sending out is, it is the women's duty, I mean, sole duty to look after the child and so on. So I think that matters a lot. So if I could ask now, two quick questions to both of you, and I mean you can jump in.
1 minute, Anupam. Just to add, lot of corporates have actually tried to cater to this need, right? One is you can bring the child to the workplace, and you have an infrastructure where you can get your nanny, or you have somebody on call who will come and take care of the child. Also, in an other instance, if you look at it, lot of policies have opted in terms of having flexible working hours, so you can still log in from home, but you continue to play that role. But one threatening thing that I have seen for a lot of my own friends who got back to workplace after their maternity break is they were put on projects which were not probably the ones they worked on in the past. So they were given projects which they felt dumbed them down in some sense, because they were capable of doing a lot more, but they were in doubt as to, given your other commitments, will you be able to fulfill this well? Or you're not put with clients who are doing really well for the business that you're part of. So though a lot of corporates, I'm talking about the privileged lot here, right? A lot of corporates are aspiring for a diversity and inclusion ratio being good and meeting that by numbers. I think it's lot more beyond that. It's not about number of women in the workspaces, but how do you ensure that you continue to have your careers despite the life-changing situations that come through? Yeah.
Right. Thanks. Actually, my question was exactly on that, which is that if I were a corporate, I would have asked, what is, the one thing, one of many things, of course, but what is that thing that I should be doing in order to make it a more pleasant experience for women to work? That's my one question. And the second question is more from a policy and from a government kind of angle, which is, if you had a wish list, what would be on top of your wish list that policy can do to increase women's labor force participation?
I'm not quite sure how much this is a policy issue to begin with. I mean, one of the things we can do is obviously, like someone said, have creches for at least in the bigger corporates or in bigger governmental agencies. But it is more a question of social expectations of a woman, and that needs to change. And both men and women need to change for that. A lot of flack I get is actually from elder women in my family, right? It's not just like the right. Men are treating me badly, right? So the social expectations stem from both sides. And
yeah, patriarchy is not a monopoly of men.
No, it's not. So, and also I think women need to do better at the workplace. I think women are not demanding enough. I think sometimes we feel that we have to step up to a man, and we end up doing things that we don't need to, right? It is okay to accept your limitations and say that this, I can do only 2 hours of my time today, but I'll do the 100% at those 2 hours, right? I think we don't do that. We say that we'll do 3 hours because we feel we have to compete with men, and it doesn't happen. I think that's a problem that women need to also address. So those are the things I would say that we should do. But I think one of the other things that the media can actually help with is making women a good example. Right? I don't think we do that enough. So, for example, we'll hear a lot about Kiran Mazumdar Shaw, but not everybody aspires to be her. Not everybody thinks that they are in a position that they can be her. But there are other women who manage their day-to-day struggles and do exemplary work that we just do not pay attention to. Right? So, for example, there is this woman in my village. Her mother-in-law set up a cashew factory, a cashew processing factory. And it is run by all women. So all employees are women, except the driver who goes and picks up this woman and leaves them at home after work. But it's run by a woman. All employees are women. And it's just a stellar, right?
Yeah.
Because you're creating employment for women in a rural place. And you're running it extremely efficiently. And we need more people like these to be exemplified.
Right.
Because a lot more people can be aspired to that, to be that person, and have the actual wherewithal to be that person.
Yeah,
just to extend that thought, I think for a lot of kids who grow up in families where, both parents are working, the children come with egalitarian views about everything that they approach. So for them, it's not like, kitchen is for the mother, or driving is dad. You kind of get a different perspective, and that's how they will probably grow into individuals who respect equally both sides, and they will also aspire to have spouse who's working and respect everything that happens in that environment. Otherwise, I've seen a lot of mockery that happens that because you don't have time to take care of what typically women should do, like the cooking and all that, you also also engage your husband into that activity. For all you know, the relationship is much better when you exercise, you cook, you do a lot of these things together as a family, and don't really bifurcate it as, you know, the gender division. And like Shambhavi rightly pointed out, I don't think it's more of a policy issue, but the social norms that exist that we need to break in terms of the barriers that we have. And women themselves putting, you know, this kind of a notion that, you know, I have to do overparenting and motherhood is something that only I can do, kind of a situation that I think a lot of times women impose, you know, these pressures on themselves. Though the society reiterates a lot of it, I think women also don't bat for good stuff in and around them. So a lot of times women don't want to let go of, oh, somebody else pitches in to take care of, you know, an aging parent or a child. You're not confident, or there is a trust deficit in that relationship. So I think if we grow out of these barriers, we'll be able to better engage with the social system and the overall, you know, workspace requirement itself.
Thanks for that. I think this ties in well with what I think Takshashila says quite often, which is that you need to find this balance between market, government and society. There are a few things that companies and therefore markets can do themselves. There's few things that government can do. I think safety, just ensuring safety, is probably the most important aspect of it. If I had to pick the policy part of it, I would imagine that women's safety and overall safety, in fact, is government's priority. But a large part of the blame and responsibility as well rests with society to make things better. Thank you so much for joining me, Soumya and Shambhavi.
Thanks
for listening in.
Thanks, Anupam.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.